Hi, I'm Skip Nipper. Welcome to my podcast, where I tell you about Nashville's great baseball history and traditions.
Shot to right, a one-hop liner.
Certainly about its past, especially about Tom Wilson Park, Herschel Greer Stadium, Sulphur Dell, but also a little bit about its present and future, too.
Yes, he can. It makes the waist-high catch.
And I introduce you to players, coaches, and other fans and their love for everything baseball.
A high fly ball down the right field corner going way back, hits a leadoff home run.
Today, my guest is David Lindsay, and let me tell you a little bit about him. We first met in Lebanon at a special baseball event a few years ago, and we got to know each other there. And over the years, he's been stalking me on Facebook. That's a joke. And we know each other a little bit more from that. He's from Columbia, Tennessee, played football and baseball there. May have played basketball, too. I don't know. We'll find out about that in a minute. And his influence has to be from his father, Eldon Lindsay, an outfielder pitcher who was also a multi-talented athlete who played professionally in the Southern Association at the AA level, not only with Nashville, but also with the Knoxville Smokies. Now, David has three brothers, Jerry, Jimmy, and Danny, and all four were exceptionally good baseball players. That includes David. Jerry was a pitcher who excelled at Georgia Tech. Danny was a pitcher, too, and Jimmy was an infielder. Now, although David was a running back in high school, where he also dropped kicked punts, he became an established catcher. And not only did he play college baseball, he became the head coach at Cumberland College, a junior college, if you can believe it, at the advanced age of 24. He's as humble as he is personable. And David, welcome to this podcast.
Well, thanks for those kind words, Skip. I don't know how humble I am, but I'll try to be.
Yeah, yes, you are. I came up with some questions. You know, number one, what piqued my interest was about your dad. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot about him. The newspapers reported him on his Nashville years, or parts of 2 years with the Vols, but the record books don't put a lot of his records out there. We need to get that
changed a little bit. And Skip, I have just one page from a scrapbook that I have right here that's got his name and picture all over it.
Yeah,
it's been through so many years, and I've got a book, it has his picture on a lot of pages. It's got the team picture here, and Raymond Johnson wrote a column about him because he was a very good hitter. He told me, now I had to assume this was the truth since my daddy told me, but he said there was a donut out in left center field that if you hit a home run through that donut, you've got a new brand new suit of clothes. And he said he did hit a home run through that circle. And I believe him. And, a new suit back then was something else.
Oh, yeah, sure it was. Because everybody wore suits if they weren't, playing.
Yeah. Well, Daddy started out in 38 playing in the Alabama and Florida League in Troy.
Right.
And his brother was a catcher. So they got to play together in 38.
That's very cool.
And then went on to Hot Springs, Arkansas. And then he came on to Nashville and he pitched for the Vols.
Yeah.
Knoxville bought his rights to pitch for Knoxville.
Right.
So Daddy pitched for Knoxville. He came back to Nashville and pitched against the Vols and beat them 1-0. Yeah,
there you go.
So, being not born yet, I don't know a whole lot about what he told me about the Nashville Vols. I know he talked about Larry Gilbert a lot.
Oh yeah, sure he did. Let me. We're going to get into a little bit more of his because I've done some research on him, and maybe there may be a few things I can tell you. Hopefully, but I know you're proud of your dad. But let me ask you this question. Mm-hmm. When did you, because you have your own career, rightfully so, that we're going to talk a little bit about. When did you first pick up a baseball?
I really think I was born with one in my crib because I can remember, this is at age three, My mother had a purse with a pretty good strap on it, and I used to put it around my neck and pretend it was a chest protector. And I'd run around the house and I'd slide like I was sliding in the home. But I also had a little plastic bat with a plastic ball. And my granddaddy came over one day and he was going to pitch me the ball. And my daddy said, "Don't throw him that ball. He'll hit it." And my granddaddy said, "Oh, he won't hit." And daddy taught me to be a left-hand hitter. He wanted me to be a left-hand hitter, although I do everything else right-handed. All of my brothers are right-handed. So I had that plastic bat. My granddaddy threw me the plastic ball, and I smacked it hard and broke the lamp. And my daddy, he was shaking, said, "I told you he would hit the ball." I remember the story, but I also remember carrying the purse myself at 3 years old. So, and I can remember many Saturdays that daddy and I would sit there and watch the Yankees with Pee Wee Reese and Dizzy Dean. I couldn't take Dizzy Dean. Yeah. Well, he slid in the third. So anyway, I think I got most of my English from Dizzy.
That's all right. Now, did I get your family right? You had three brothers?
I have two older brothers. My oldest brother, Jerry, who pitched at Georgia Tech, is deceased. He died in 2017. I have another brother, Jim, who's 8 years older than me. Then my younger brother is 3 years younger than me. He died in 1991. And then I have a sister that is, I'm 9 years older than my sister. She was the baby, the last one of the family, and happened to be a girl. And don't you know, she was my daddy's favorite at the time. She could say, "I'm going to go burn down the garage, daddy." And daddy would say, "Here's the matches, honey."
What's her name?
Her name was Vicky.
That's awesome. Did you play in youth leagues as you were growing up? You talked about that 3-year experience, and then from there it had to have grown.
Yes, like all youngsters that lived in a small town, and we had little league baseball. I started when I was 9. Funny story about that is, at 9 years old, my daddy said he'd give me a quarter for every time I got a hit. Well, we were playing twice a week. And at 9 years old, I was going 3 for 4, 2 for 3, 3 for 3. And he finally, after 3 weeks, said, "Listen, I hate to renege on this," but said, "I'm not giving you a quarter anymore." Well, at the end of the year, I wound up batting second in the league with an average of .513. And a 12-year-old beat me by 20-something points. So the All-Star committee wanted to put me on the All-Star team, but you had to be 11 and 12 to be on the All-Star team. And so I couldn't make the All-Star team. So I think when I was 9 was probably my best year in Little League.
Well, your dad was a very strong influence on you.
Yes.
For that, I'm sure. And you went on and played through 12 years old in Little League or Youth League?
American Legion ball, Babe Ruth, American Legion, in high school baseball.
And you went to where, high school?
I went to Columbia Central High School, played football under Coach Jim Cartwright.
Oh, yeah. A big name.
He gave me the name of Redbird.
Redbird.
That's awesome. And my brother Danny played 3 years after me, and his nickname was Bird Legs.
And now, the football stadium is named after Jim Cartwright, I think.
Yes, it is. He's the one that let me drop kick. We couldn't find anybody that could kick an extra point. And one day we were practicing in the stadium. And one day I said, "Hey, coach, I can drop kick them through there." He said, "Come on, Eldon." He called me Eldon too.
He said,
"Come on, Eldon, get up here and show me." And I got behind, I drop kicked it, went straight through the goalpost. He said, "Now that was luck. Let me see if you do it again." And I did it again. It went through the goalpost. He said, "I'll tell you what I do. If we score against Murfreesboro Central, which was number one in the state, we were playing them next. He said, if we score, I'll let you drop kick an extra point." Well, we got the ball first, marched down the field, and scored. And so I lined up by myself back there with nobody with me, and Murfreesboro didn't understand what was going on. Wow. They thought I was going to pass the ball or something. Well, I drop kicked it, and it went straight through the goalpost. I was scared to death. And after the game, Coach Murphy at MTSU went up to Cartwright, and he used a he said, "GD, I hadn't seen since that, since Jim Thorpe." And so Coach Cartwright told me that, and I was very pleased. I went on, and I think I kicked three more with the remaining games we had. But it was something I practiced all the time in the yard. I knew I could do it.
That's pretty good to be compared to Jim Thorpe.
Yeah, I know it. I love the movie. But I think I'm the only one that has ever done that. And I don't know how many years.
Wow.
You know,
I don't know. What's happening today?
No, Marion Wilhart, bless his heart. I love Marion. He was such a great sports writer. He was going to look that up for me when the last time, but he got sick and he passed away. And I hated that with all my heart because he wrote my father's obituary and he wrote my younger brother's obituary. And I said, "Marion, you've got to live long enough to write my obituary," because I knew he could do a great job. And I went to see him when he was sick in the hospital here in Nashville, and bless his heart, he was the best sports writer I've ever known that couldn't drive a car.
Yeah. Now, you played halfback also, I think, in football.
Yes.
What positions did you play in baseball for Columbia?
Well, actually, I didn't start catching until my senior year in high school. My sophomore year, I played third base and second base. Now, I do have a story I'd like to tell you about that.
Sure.
We played in the district tournament in Nashville at TPS. Gerald Montgomery, and I kid Gerald about this, so I'm not saying anything that he doesn't know, that I haven't kidded him every time I see him.
Yeah.
But Gerald Montgomery was the NIL Pitcher of the Year that year. And so we were playing them at TPS, and he was the starting pitcher for Antioch. And so they were the visiting team, and they scored 5 runs in the first inning. So they decided, well, Gerald's not going to pitch. We've got 5 runs. It's no use wasting him. So the umpire said he has to pitch to one guy.
Yeah.
So the first batter up got a hit. Gerald walked the second batter, and then I came up third. I hit a line drive shot between right and center field that rolled all the way to the wall at TPS, and I had pretty good speed for a catcher. Even though I wasn't catching at the time, I was playing second base, actually. But I scored. I hit a home run.
Awesome.
So it made it 5-3, and Gerald had to go on and pitch several more innings. And they wound up beating us 9-3.
Yeah.
When I see Gerald, I always kid that to him, because in any other park, it probably would have been a double. But at TPS, it rolled all the way to the building.
Yeah, well, anybody that knows anything about Gerald Montgomery, that was quite a feat, because he was a heck of a pitcher. Yep.
Yes, and he was.
Brother to Bob Montgomery, who
was
catching for the Red Sox. And I've run across a couple of names of ball fields there in Columbia. Mahler Park and Pillar Park.
Oh, Mahler Park. My daddy, when he quit playing professional baseball, he moved back to Columbia, and Tennessee Knitting Mills had a company, and they had a ball club. And so they gave him a job to play. So he played 1 year with them. And then Monsanto, which was the big name then, they hired him to play. Well, I hired him to work, but they really wanted to pitch for their baseball team. And I can remember as a 10, 11-year-old going out to Mahler Park. This ballpark, it didn't have a grandstand, but it had a 10-foot-high green wall around the whole ballpark, and it had a big scoreboard in left field that was manually operated by 2 people, and they had a 30 or 40-foot-high press box.
Yeah.
And Daddy, when he played with Monsanto, he would give me his glove before the game when they were taking batting practice, and I would shag the fly balls while he stood there and talked. And this ballpark was something else. It had a visitor and a home team locker room. And Daddy would let me go into the locker room after the games for a couple of times. Then he realized that it really wasn't a place for a 10 or 11-year-old boy to be with the language going on and stuff like that. But it was a great ballpark that they tore down finally. And then, of course, anybody that's ever been to Columbia knows about Pillar Park. I worked there many a year before I graduated from high school. I worked on the grounds crew there, and I worked for the recreation department most of the time. A guy named Brudge Pickard, but was the recreation director at the time. And before he became recreation director, he was the offensive coach my sophomore year as my backfield coach for Jim Cartwright. So I knew him very well.
Yeah. But, is Pillar Park still there?
Pillar Park is, no, it's not.
Yeah.
They built softball fields around it, and they put some kind of memorial, but the actual park is not there anymore.
Not there anymore.
But I used to, I'll get into that later about Pillar Park.
Yeah. Was that where the Columbia Mules played when they had a team in the old, what was that, the old, late 1900s or so? They had.
Well, yes, home plate was changed at least three times before it stuck at its original spot that most people know. But, yeah, the Columbia Mules played there. Monsanto has played some games there until they built their park, and that's where they played. And at that Monsanto ballpark, the Mahler ballpark, as a kid, if you got a foul ball, you brought it back, you got a dime.
Oh, gosh.
And I mean, I'm telling you, there were some fights over some foul balls because a dime to a kid back then, it was a lot of money. And I mean, there were big kids, and I was right in there with them. I wasn't that big, but I could be lucky enough sometime to get it before they got
there
it.
There you go. Now, when you graduated, you signed a football scholarship with Memphis State.
Well, let me correct you there.
Okay.
I went to Columbia Military Academy as a postgraduate.
Okay. Did not know that.
Now, being from Columbia, we used to make fun of CMA. The guys would walk around in their uniforms downtown, and of course, we'd holler, "Bellhop, Bellhop." And I said, I would never go to school there. And even though when I was younger, my dad would take me out on Saturday nights, they had a no limit on postgraduates then. And they were like a junior college football team playing.
Right.
And so we would go out there on Saturday nights, and I'd watch CMA play football. But I would tell people I would never go to CMA, never. After I graduated from high school and didn't have the scholarship offers I wanted, or I think Austin Peay had offered something to me, but I didn't really want to go there. So they got a new head coach at CMA football, and I had grown up knowing him, and my daddy had coached him in Little League. Had coached him in American Legion. His name was Pete Harris. He's no longer alive. Come to find out, the backfield coach was Brudge Pickard, who was my coach as a sophomore and also was the recreation director. So I said, hey, I'm coming to CMA. And I'm telling you, Skip, that was the best year of my life. I knew what I was going to wear to school every day. It was no girls around. I didn't have to try to impress anybody or anything like that. And I'd already graduated from high school, so I was there to play sports.
Yeah.
And I played football, basketball, and baseball for CMA. And I loved every minute of it. Loved it.
Yeah, loved sounds it. Like it was a good experience for you. So then you signed a football scholarship with Memphis State.
Yes. Pete Harris, the coach Pete Harris, had gone to Memphis State. He actually pitched for Memphis State.
Yeah.
Well, we ran all of Memphis State's plays in our offense. So we had a total of 11 guys sign scholarships off of that CMA team. Although we could only have 7 postgraduates on the team, that was all that were allowed. And I know 2 boys from Pulaski were postgraduates, and another guy from Columbia, a friend of mine, was a postgraduate. So we could only have 7 postgraduates. And we even actually had to sit out of 2 high school games because we were postgraduates. We couldn't play.
Right,
and we won. And we had a record of, I think, 9-1, something like that. We got beat by Darlington, Georgia. But I led the conference in rushing at CMA. I had gained about 20 pounds from high school to CMA, and I was the leading ground gainer for CMA. But 6 of us went to Memphis State. And I think that's the reason I chose Memphis State, because I knew 5 of the guys from that team were going.
Right.
And also, when I signed, the recruiter said, and I asked him bluntly, and my dad was there, and Coach Harris was there. I said, can I play baseball and football? He said, you sure can. I said, well, then I'm signing to come play with you.
Yeah.
So I signed with Memphis State, And I went down there in the fall of 66. No matter how good you were then as a freshman, you couldn't play with the varsity.
Right.
We were just more or less tackling dummies for the varsity. And I felt like that. We were brought out to the field, set up, and the varsity would knock the crap out of us and then take us back in after practice. So we just strictly had a freshman team. The first game we played as a freshman was against LSU. And it's ironic that LSU was one of my favorite colleges. It's where I always really wanted to go to school was LSU, either that or Florida State, because I knew they had good baseball teams and good football teams. And so I wanted to go to LSU. And so you can imagine going out onto that field and seeing LSU coming out in their gold and purple uniforms. And so I was a wing back at the time. And like I said, we ran all of the plays at CMA. So when I started Memphis State, they didn't know where to play me at halfback, fullback. And they finally wound up playing me at wingback. And the coach even said, well, hell, Lindsay, you can play any position. You know all the players.
Multi-talented.
Yeah, yes, I do. And so that made me feel good. But the wingback was supposed to be the breakaway guy, the guy that could score the touchdown or whatever. And let me jump back a little bit, because we scrimmaged the varsity in the stadium one day, and there they had regular referees all dressed out in their uniforms and things. And I ran a 20-yard touchdown against the varsity, and several guys had missed me. I wasn't real fast, but I was pretty shifty. And my daddy had always told me, he said, run like you're scared. And I was.
Yeah.
So if we needed a yard, I'd run over. I'd try to run over and make the yard. But if we didn't need that yard, it wasn't no use running into the guy if I could run around him. And I was known for juking and had a low center balance there. So I ran a touchdown. And the most thing that sticks out in my mind is I can hear the defensive coach for the varsity over there with his defense. And they had a video of it. And they said, he was saying, look, you missed him. You missed him. You missed him. You missed him.
Using as an example.
Yes. And so that was the greatest thing to hear. But anyway, we played LSU, and I ran the ball first time and I gained 4 yards, ran the second time, I gained 3.5. And on the second time, I felt something pop in my knee. And I went back to the huddle, and I turned my knee to the inside. I said, oh, no. I said, hey, I can't make it, guys. So they had to carry me off to the sideline. And what's bad is my dad was sick in the hospital, and he couldn't make the game. But my girlfriend from high school and her mother made the game, and I was only in for 2 plays. To end the story, LSU beat us 33-0, and a coach at halftime was pretty upset. Glass Coca-Cola bottle was thrown at halftime against the wall, even though I was in the other room on the table being looked at. I heard the bottle and him hollering. But anyway, they had the number one recruiting class in the country that year. So it was pretty well a factor that reason they beat us 33-0. But I went to the hospital that day, and the doctor shook both of my knees. And he said, which one did you hurt? And I said, this one, my left one. He said, well, what did you do all summer? I said, well, I caught 60-something ball games in American Legion. He said, son, don't you know that's the worst thing for a running back for his knees is to be a catcher? So I said, well, no, sir, I didn't know that. But thanks for telling me. But anyway, yeah. I partially tore a ligament, Skip. It would have been better if I had torn the ligament, because they could have gone in there and operated on it, tied it in a knot or whatever they do.
Right.
But since I partially tore it, I had to wear a cast from my thigh to my ankle for 6 weeks. And I had to go to class wearing that, ripping all my pants or just wear sweatpants to class. In the meantime, after the season was over, I went to the head coach, who was
Spook Murphy.
Yeah. I knew I get them confused with the coach at MTSU, but it was Spook Murphy. And I went to him and had a meeting scheduled with him. And I was scared to death as a freshman walking into his big office with him sitting behind his big desk. And I said, coach, when I signed my scholarship, Coach Hoggett said I could play baseball also. And he jumped up and slammed the table with his hand and made me get scared to death. I'm surprised I didn't wet my britches at the time. He said, son, you signed a GD football scholarship.
Yeah.
You signed a football scholarship. You're not a baseball player.
Yeah.
So I left his office really defeated. And after hurting my leg, I really didn't want to play any more football. I really was scared it would ruin my baseball career. And I went to the head baseball coach and I talked to him. And he said, I'm sorry, David. He said, we've filled all our scholarships. I would love for you to be a walk-on if you'd like to walk on. And I said, well, I'm going to walk on. I said, that's for sure. Well, in the spring, we started spring practice and I didn't want to play. I didn't really want to, but I had two spring practice. I wasn't feeling good. I was tired. I was weak. I wasn't hungry. I had the chills. And the second spring practice, I had a doctor's appointment after that. And I went to the doctor and the doctor said, David, you have mononucleosis.
Yeah. Oh my.
You need to leave.
Yeah.
And I swear, Skip, I don't know that I could have been any happier to have a disease. And it felt like as soon as I hit the city limits of Columbia, knowing that my girlfriend was back home and mother. And by then, my father had passed away in December. So I knew he wasn't going to be there. But I felt like I got well as soon as I got back in the city limits of Columbia. And started working for Ronnie Norton at the Pillow Park. I was the ground supervisor for Ronnie Norton. He was the recreation director at the time. And, of course, I've known Ronnie and his family. My daddy coached Ronnie and through Little League and through American Legion Ball. And my brother would want me to tell you this story. His Little League team, my brother Jim, they were one win away from going to Williamsport in Little League. Yes, and so he's always proud of that they were one game away. And so I got back to Columbia. I worked at the recreation department. I got married to my high school sweetheart. You know, I worked there all summer. And it's funny, Columbia State at the time didn't have a building, and naturally they didn't have a field, so they practiced at Pillow Park. And since I was the supervisor of the grounds crew, I could tell them to go do whatever. And I would watch Columbia State practice. And the basketball coach was actually the coach of the baseball team. And I met several people there that became really good friends of mine at Columbia State. And one day they asked me, would I umpire the game that they were having against Freed Hardman? I said, well, I'm not going to do it behind the plate, but I said, I'll umpire the bases. And so I got my black shirt and hat, and I got out there, and I umpired the bases. And like I said, I had two real good friends. One played shortstop named Joe Wishy. He went on to play at Tennessee Tech. And another guy named Dwight White from Lawrenceburg that was eat up with baseball. He would love and talk and eat and sleep and everything with baseball, kind of like you, kind of like you at that.
If he was a good baseball player, he's nothing like me.
Well, he was a pretty fair baseball player. But anyway, he would play in second base and Joe was playing short. Well, Columbia State was getting beat 18-1. Okay. And so this boy hit a trip and I told Dwight and Joe heard me. I said, Dwight, he missed second base. He missed second base. And so Joe heard me and he started laughing. And so Dwight, he's hollering, give me the ball. Give me the ball. And so he gets the ball and he steps on second base. And I give him the safe sign. And he goes, he couldn't say anything. And Joe was about to die laughing. It was so funny to him to see Dwight react. Because Dwight was wanting to say, well, you told me he missed second. Well, he knew an umpire couldn't tell him he missed second. But
you set him up.
I felt like since they were getting beat 18-1, it was no big deal.
Yeah,
and they did finally get beat terribly. Yeah. So anyway, from then on, I went to Columbia State. Dave Hall came in. That was his first year. And Dave Hall came there. So I started my first year at Columbia State in 67.
Yeah.
It was the spring.
So you played two seasons.
Yes.
Baseball at Columbia State. And you called.
Yeah.
Did you play any other position?
No, I called. I only called.
Because right after that, you transferred to David Lipscomb. Of course, you had 2 years of eligibility left, I suppose, right?
Yes.
So number one, I guess that was an enjoyable 2 years at Columbia State.
So I lived a mile from the school with my wife and her mother.
You know, one of the things great about Tennessee is we have always had great junior college baseball teams. The programs have always been excellent. But you moved to David Lipscomb, which was David Lipscomb College back in those days. And what kind of experience was that? Because I know there was the legendary coach Ken Dugan there, and he was your coach.
Yes, he was, along with Dave Hall. Dave Hall was a great coach at Columbia State, too. Let me tell you that. Dave Hall was a coach that was fun to be around and fun to play for. And he liked jokes with the best of them. When I got to Lipscomb, I had told Coach Dugan that if I play for you, Coach, I'm going to have fun. And so I had fun. And if you think about it, Skip, my junior year, I was like a fifth-year senior. My junior year, I had graduated from high school and then played a year at Columbia Military Academy, then went to Memphis State and lost a year. Then I played 2 years at Columbia State. That's 4 years. So when I got to be a junior at Lipscomb, I was a pretty old junior. Yeah. And Coach Dugan, I told him I was going to have fun. And he said, that's okay with me. He said, I just want you to come and catch for me. I said, and I knew at the time playing in Nashville, with the write-ups you could get from the Tennessean and the Banner at the time, and being a Church of Christ school, a religious school, I figured that I could get a job in coaching. That was my goal, to be a college coach. Yep. And I enjoyed playing for Coach Dugan. A lot of people, they had their ups and downs with Coach Dugan, but he never got on me one time. Actually, to be honest with you, Coach Dugan would call me into his office at times and would ask me, should I start so-and-so this today or should I go with so-and-so? And I would give him my opinion on it. And he did that several times. And that made me feel like I had a special relationship with Ken Dugan. And I did.
Yeah, undoubtedly you were trustworthy and you knew the game. Your experience, your age, your experience certainly had something to do with that, right?
Yeah. All right. And during the games, we had a signal. If I thought he should take a guy out, we had a signal where I would either take off my mask and or rub, throw some dirt towards our dugout or something like that. We had a signal either to leave him in or take him out. He looked at me, found out in coaching that's the toughest decision to make, whether to take out or leave a pitcher in.
Well, in those days, the catchers called the pitches. I guess you called the pitches, didn't you?
Well, let me just say that. I call pitches whenever I caught. I told the pitchers, let me call the pitches. If they start hitting what I'm calling, then you could start calling them.
Right.
And when I played with Corsi's Barbecue back in 1967, before I went to Columbia State, I played with Corsi's Barbecue, which had Jamie Tillman as a pitcher, Russ Wingo as a pitcher, Farrell Owens was center field, we had Ronnie Bergetzi, had Jim Ferguson, and Ronnie Norton was first base. Ronnie's the one that got me on the team. Ronnie and I would drive up from Columbia twice a week to play for Corsi's, and I was catching for Corsi's at 19. I was the youngest player on the team at that time. And while I was doing that at Nashville, I was also playing for the Columbia Eagles, which was a black team in Columbia. And two other guys that I mentioned at Columbia State, Joe Wishy and Dwight White, they also were playing for the Columbia Eagles. But they didn't show up a lot of times because they lived out of town and they went home on some of those game days. And so some days I was the only white guy in that ballpark and they treated me like royalty. I was a star.
What league did they play in, the Columbia Eagles?
Well, they just played other teams around the area, but there were a lot of older guys. The athletic director or the recreation director for Fairview Park, the black park in Columbia at the time. He's the one that wanted me to play because I would have to go over there when I was working at the recreation center in Columbia. I would have to go over there to Fairview Park to help them out, and they would have to come and help me out sometimes. And I got to know him real well. And so there were older guys, a lot of older guys, but whenever I could play with them, I was playing with them, and I was also playing with the Corsi's Barbecue.
Well, Fairview Park must have been for the a park for the black community. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes,
and
it was.
And then Corsi's, for those that don't know, that was a tri-state league team, which is in our era, but there are a lot of people that don't know how strong that was. There was some ex-pros that played. And I've read a lot, and Farrell used to talk about what great games they played there and about one of the championships and things like that. So Corsi's and others have quite a lengthy tradition of amateur baseball.
Yeah, we won the district, the regional, and we finished second in the nation up there. And Corsi's did.
Well, you had a great year that then, because you also was that the same year that Lipscomb went to the district.
This was before I went to Columbia State, Skip.
Now I get it. All right. But while you were at Lipscomb, your first year at Lipscomb, you had 2 years of eligibility.
Yes, sir.
All right. This is what kind of a player you were. You were, not only did David Lipscomb qualify for the NAIA regional, which I think it was you were out after one game, it's single elimination.
You were
named NAIA All District and honorable mention All American. And you were named Lipscomb's Most Valuable Player for 1970. That was your first season there.
Yes, it was. Yes, sir.
That says so much about you and your ability. Of course, the trust factor, I didn't know. I'm glad to hear about that Ken Dugan had in you to ask you about pitchers and plays and games. So my hat's off my cap. I don't call it a hat. It's a cap.
I see it.
My cap's off to you.
Yeah. Well, thank you for bringing it up.
Yeah.
The senior year, I was promoted as to be Lipscomb first All-American.
Yeah.
And I was on the picture of the program for the 71 season. And I didn't have a very good senior year. Early in the season, after about 10 games, I think it was, we had a freshman pitcher. And we had like a 10-0 lead. And they were a man on first and third. And I was going to do my best to protect this freshman shutout. And a guy on first and third. And the guy on first stole. So I threw the ball to try to cut him down. Well, the guy on third took off, and naturally we used a cutoff play. And he slid into me and somehow twisted my ankle. I got him out, saved the boys. He pitched a shutout, but I saved his shutout. But the guy twisted my ankle. I could not play. Well, I tried to play first base a couple of games because I could not swing like I want to because of my ankle, but I came back too soon.
Yeah.
And so my hitting was never like it should have been like it was my junior year. I hate to make excuses, but that was a legit excuse. I really actually hurt my ankle and I tried to play too soon. I wanted to play too soon. And so I think I hit the lowest my senior year that I've ever batted in my life and didn't make anything my senior year, but we did go to the national first team to go to the NAIA World Series.
Right.
And there we were a snow cone catch away from winning the World Series. We lost the first game and was put in the loser's bracket. And so when you get in the loser's bracket, you use a lot of pitchers, but we were behind in several games in the ninth inning, and we would come back. I would tell myself, well, this is the last time I'm going to have to put these shin guards on. And I tell you, we would come back, and we came back in at least 3 to 4 games and won those games. And our nickname was the Comeback Bisons during that time. Paul Eels did the radio broadcast of the World Series, and I had the privilege of eating lunch with him one day and talked to him for a long time, which I'll never forget. Right. But we got in the loser's bracket, but then we got to the final two games. We had to beat Glenfield, Oregon 2 games. Well, we beat them the first game, so we had to play them again, and they had a 7-6 in the ninth inning. We had a runner on first and second and 2 outs. And the player at bat hit a long fly ball to the left fielder, and he made a snow cone catch of the ball. And if he had just been 2 inches more or what, he would have dropped it. The run would have scored from second, and we would have probably won the game. I mean, yeah, right. But we finished second, and we were the first team to ever go to the World Series.
Oh, man.
And it was because of Coach Ken Dugan, and also we had some outstanding freshmen that year that really, really were good. Guys by the name of Mike Santee, who is Dr. Santee now, and Buddy Harston, who's the golf coach at Lipscomb and stuff. Right. And they were magnificent freshmen. Jamie Pride, another name.
Great
so
name.
Yeah. We had some experience and then some really good freshmen that followed along with us. So
Were you scouted by the pros at all, or did you know that you would have or approached by them?
Well, after my American Legion season, which was the best season I ever had in my life, I think of 10 out of 10 categories of at-bat, average, runs, hits, home runs and stuff, I finished out 8 out of 10 leading in those categories.
Yeah.
And in high school, we played BGA, and Ralph Brown, I don't know whether you know that name or not, but Ralph Brown used to be a coach at BGA, and he knew my dad. And Ralph Brown saw me play, and he was a bird dog for the Yankees, bird dog scout.
Yeah.
And so he called his guy in Little Rock, Arkansas. He was an older gentleman. And so I had a separate single tryout in Pillow Park for a Yankee scout that came all the way from Little Rock to watch me. And Ronnie Norton was pitching to me. And I got another friend to catch for me and a couple of other friends that would chag for me.
Yeah.
And so the scout, you know, he wanted to see me bat. So Ronnie knew how, even though I didn't like batting against left-handed pitcher, I'd rather bat against right-handed pitcher any day.
Sure.
And even though in the neighborhoods, when I played at neighborhood ball, I had to bat right-handed because I hit the ball too hard as a left-hander. So they made me bat right-handed. And all through my life, I wanted to be a switch hitter. And, you know, every coach, you ask your little league coach, "Coach, can I take some swings right-handed?" Well, they say, "Well, David, if we let you, we're going to have to let everybody else do it."
Yeah.
So I never did. Then getting Babe Ruth, same thing. We'd have to let everybody. Then we're getting American Legion ball, same thing.
Yeah.
And I know I'm skipping back some, but Dave Hall at Columbia State finally let me bat right-handed against Freed Hardman. He threw a little left-hander that he wasn't very fast, but he was a little cunny thumber left-hander that threw a little dinky curveball and, you know, about an 85 mile per hour fastball. And I said, "Coach, let me bat right-handed against him." He said, "All right, David, you got the chance." I went 2 for 3.
Oh, wow.
It was the only time I ever batted right-handed in my life. And I went 2 for 3. And I honestly never did like left-handers. And I'll tell you, the left-hander that gave me the most problem was Steve Willis.
Is at Vanderbilt. Right?
I didn't like batting against him. And the right-hander that gave me the most trouble was Jerry Bell.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't like to bat against Jerry Bell, and I tell him that to this day. Yeah. And also another left-hander played at Jackson State that went on and played at in Cincinnati was Ross Grimsley.
Oh, sure.
He pitched at Jackson State, and he's the only guy that I know that ever struck me out 3 times in a game. And when they came to Columbia to play, Dave Hall said, "You ought to write off that you can hit left-handed pitchers." And I wrote off 100 times, "I can hit left-handed pitchers. I can hit left-handed pitchers." And I wrote that off 100 times.
Yeah. And power of positive thinking.
I actually hit a home run against him in Pillow Park. So okay. I've made up for those 3 strikeouts, but he went on and pitched at Cincinnati. But I'm sorry to get off the subject.
No, it's not at all. No, about the pros. How far did it go after your tryout to the possibility?
Okay. During that time, I had my scholarship to Memphis State when I tried out. And I was surely wanting to play baseball more than I was football.
Right.
And so I had to try out. And it was a very hot day in August. And the 1st of August, and Ronnie was throwing them right where he knew I wanted. And I was hitting them out. I mean, I was blasting them out of the ballpark. And I bet I took 8 to 10 minutes of batting practice. If anybody has ever hit for 8 for 10 minutes, that can wear yourself out. Now, the guy said, "Okay, on this last swing, I want to see you run to first base as fast as you can. Well, I swung and I ran as fast as I could. And he timed it. And he said, very good time. Very good time for a catcher. Excellent time, he said, for a catcher. My daddy was there and he was talking to him. And then he said, all right, we'll do it one more time. I said, good gracious. Oh, I just got through running one. So anyway, I swung again and I ran as hard as I could to first base again. And he said, good time. So then he wanted to get me to get behind the plate and he wanted me to throw to second. Yeah, now, by this time, I am really tired. And so, but I was still throwing the ball as hard as I could to second base and I was putting it on the bag for him, putting it on the bag. Well, after the thing was over, he told my dad, he said, I'm going to tell you something, Toby. That was my daddy's nickname. He said, Toby, he's a diamond in the rough. And we can offer him a little money, but it's not going to be what he's wanting. Right then and there, the Vietnam War was hot going on. And I knew I needed to get in college. Yep. Now, I did have a slight advantage being married. I'm ahead of myself now. I wasn't married at that time. Anyway, I knew I had an advantage with a scholarship. And so what they were trying to offer was not worth my scholarship at the time, considering the Vietnam War and considering what a football scholarship was worth. So I had that time. And then later on, after I played at Columbia State, Shaky Kane.
Oh, yeah. Great name in national baseball.
Yes. And Larry Kane, I know Larry real well. But his dad, he talked to me and he offered me an opportunity to go to Tacoma, Washington to play for the Cubs. And I was married and I had a kid at the time.
Yeah.
And I still had two more years of college at Lipscomb that was guaranteed. And I couldn't see going and just playing and getting paid for playing in the summertime at the time and having a child and everything like that. So I had to work. Actually, Skip, I worked at Hooker Chemical Company between my freshman and sophomore years playing slow pitch softball.
Yeah.
And I had to work shift work. And then between my sophomore year and my junior year at Lipscomb, I worked at Monsanto Chemical Company because they offered me a straight day job to play softball for them. Right. And I actually wound up playing softball for Monsanto with guys that had played baseball that were real young that had played baseball with my dad.
Yeah.
And when I got the job at Monsanto, I actually got on the same crew that my dad worked with. He was a welder. So I got on the same crew with my daddy at Monsanto, and they really gave me, you know, they gave me a lot. They laid it on me. They said, my daddy, he said, you're just like your daddy. You're not afraid of work. You can lay down right beside it and go to sleep. Yeah, and it was a real good time. But I tell you what, after working at those two plants, I told myself, I said, self, you got to get a college education.
Yeah, right.
And I can remember my daddy every Sunday night and his cuss word was dad doon. And Sunday nights he would say, dad doon, I'd rather take a beating than go to that place in the morning. So I know what he was talking about now. And that's the reason kept me going to college.
I think you said earlier that you always want to play baseball. Did you have aspirations to be a coach?
That's always been my aspiration. That has always been it. And I felt like I was a coach at Lipscomb just a little bit. And I mean, not taking anything away from Coach Dugan, but we actually talked about a lot of things about coaching. My daddy probably was my best coach. My daddy was probably my best coach. And then Dave Hall taught me a lot. And I learned a lot from Ken Dugan.
Yeah.
And after my 2 years at Lipscomb, some of the players told me that they had never seen Coach Dugan laugh and smile as much as he did.
He wasn't my 2 years. Was he?
No, he was not. But I was going to have fun, and I had fun. And if Coach Dugan didn't like it, then he would tell me. And he never told me to quit doing anything. And one funny story, Coach Skip. One funny story in our trip to Florida. We had a trainer named Doc Dave Evans, Evans, and then Adams, Doc Adams. And we had a little short person named Clark Mitchell. He was a little short person. And we'd go on these trips, and I was married. And I told Coach Dugan, I said, Coach, I can't room or sleep with somebody. I need a separate bed. And he said, well, we can get you a rollaway bed. You can stay room with Doc Adams and Clark Williams, the manager. Well, I got in the room, and they said, well, it's not fair that you get the rollaway bed. We'll flip to see who gets the rollaway bed. Well, we flipped the coins, and I lost. I got the rollaway bed. Coach Dugan comes in for a bed check, and there I am with my feet hanging over a rollaway bed. The little Clark Williams was in the big twin-size bed, and Doc was in the other. And Coach Dugan said, what are you doing in that bed? I said, Coach, I lost the flip. he said, well, you got to catch tomorrow. I said, I know, Coach, but fair's fair. I got to stay in the bed. But Coach Dugan was laughing so much to see Clark Williams in that big bed, and as little as he was, and me in the big, bed as big as I was.
You honored the bet. That's only fair. All right. After Lipscomb, at 24 years old, you became the head baseball coach at Cumberland College.
Yes.
How did that happen? I'm not questioning how it happened. I just wonder the process for you to get
after
to
that. After I left Lipscomb, I went in the insurance business with my brother, Jim. He had his own agency. And I was going back to MTSU to get my master's degree because I knew having a master's degree was going to get me a coaching job a lot better. So I was going on Saturdays and Monday nights or whatever. It's whenever I could go and get the classes. But I was trying to sell insurance too. And I sold insurance. You know, naturally, you get your friends and your family as much as you can first, you know. And a couple of guys had gotten married that would play baseball, so I would sell them a policy. But I didn't like it. I didn't like it at all. And I hopped around doing the best I could. And then one day, Coach Dugan called me. He said, David, he said, there's an opening for a baseball coach at Cumberland Junior College. I put your name in up there. Why don't you go talk to the president? I said, okay. So I made an appointment to go talk to the president, Dr. Ernest Stockton.
Yeah.
And I walked in and talked to him. And he had known my mother. My mother and dad went to Cumberland University when it was back at Cumberland University. Right. And he had a crush on my mom. Now, I don't know whether that had anything to do with me getting the job or whether it was Coach Dugan. But he hired me right on the spot to be the baseball coach for Cumberland College.
Right.
And so I was tickled. And he said this too. He said, we'll pay for you to go back. And I let 12 hours having my master's. He said, your first year, you will be strictly a coach, but you will be director of intramurals.
Right.
But you will not teach. And we will fix up they took up an old dorm room and made it into an apartment for us with a refrigerator and a stove for my wife and my son. And they sent me back to MTSU to get my master's. And I was coaching. I had a fall baseball practice naturally. And I got my master's the next year and became a teacher and a coach. Cliff Ellis was the athletic director at the time. And he stayed there 3 years, and just as I stayed three, but he stayed 3 years and then went to South Alabama to coach, and then he went to Clemson to coach, and then he went to Auburn to coach, and I think got in some recruiting problems in Auburn, even though they went to the Elite Eight a couple of times. Anyway, he went on to Coastal Carolina to be coach, and I just read on Google that he retired from head coaching at Coastal Carolina.
Yeah.
But he was the athletic director at Cumberland College. And some of the things I could tell you about coaching at Cumberland, it was a tough job. I was young and I wasn't too far from the age of some of the the sophomores players. And stuff.
Yeah.
And I came in with some rules, and, you know, some of them didn't like some of the rules, but, you know, I had to go through some of those rules. And that my first year there, we won 20 games. I know that doesn't sound like much, right, but at the time, that was the most games that Cumberland College had ever won in a baseball season.
Right.
Was 20 games. And I know that sounds very, it's not even any comparison to what they
played
today.
Quite an accomplishment at the time, wasn't it?
Well, at the time it was.
Yeah,
and I had three scholarships now. That's all I had. And I was having to compete with Vol State, Montlow, Columbia State, all the state community college. And I had three full scholarships. And Cumberland being a private school, it costs some money to come to Cumberland. So I'd have to take coach's word that this boy was good. And I'd give him maybe $400 or $500 towards your scholarship money and stuff like that.
Right.
And so after winning 20 games, my first year, the most in the history, the next year, I was cut a half scholarship. Cliff had five to begin with, and it was a basketball team. I know his was the money sport. They paid to get in the basketball games. They didn't pay to get into baseball. So he had five. And I didn't have an assistant coach. I was the only guy out there amongst these guys. And it was hard to have practice. I had to really schedule my practice with a time limit on doing each thing. And I did that, which I knew to do that. But I didn't have an assistant coach. And Cliff had five scholarships. And I had three. Well, then the next year, I had two and a half, and Cliff had eight. So I didn't like that.
I don't blame you.
I was very disappointed. Even though I still didn't have an assistant coach, I never had an assistant coach while I was there. We had a winning season all 3 years I was there. We had winning seasons. But my third,
I found where your three seasons total was 44 wins and 28 losses. Of course, you didn't have, did you have a fence? Did you have any fences back in those days? You just had a backstop, probably, didn't you?
We had a backstop. We had a fence, but it had to come down at the end of the year. We had a wood picket fence that we had to make the holes for the iron bars to stick in so you could tie the picket fence up. And we'd put the picket fence up every year, and then we'd have to take it down. That was a really a hassle. And of course, I didn't have anybody. I tell you what my players learned. They had a degree in how to make a baseball field playable. They learned how to drag the field. They learned how to rake the field. And one day I had a guy that it was wet, been wet. And you know, when you're playing teams from Morristown or Roan State, you have to let them know there's no use them traveling all this way and not being able to play. So I'd have to look at the weather forecast and have to let them know. Well, one day a guy, he gave us a bunch of oil drums that we could burn the field off with.
Right. Yeah,
and I'd burned fields off in Columbia before. And so we got to burn it, and that was the blackest smoke that I'd ever seen. And they were calls to the president, calls to the school, what is going on? Is there fire at Cumberland? And so the president kind of got on me a little bit about that. That's what I was telling him. But Skip, one thing that gets me about the president, the second year I was there, I had donations enough for them to make dugouts. All we had were benches. We had two long benches for each team. And on the side, we were on the third base side. They were on the first base side. Two long white benches. Well, I had got enough money donated that this person was going to build us dugouts for nothing. Well, I went to President Stockton about it. And I told him, I said, Dr. Stockton, I have got money for us to build dugouts on the baseball field. And he would say, Coach, you know, I don't know whether those funny looking houses would look good out there or not. And I said, Dr. Stockton, the funny looking houses would look funny up around the administration building. But I said, on the baseball field, they're very appropriate. Right. And so he nixed that deal and I didn't get them. I almost had money to get lighting.
Yeah.
And didn't want that at the time. Didn't want anything really. And after my third year there, recruiting got awfully hard and I didn't have any assistant coaches. And it the worst mistake, I think, even though my life right now is great, being retired, I'm financially great. My second wife is I've been married to for 25 years. It's great, wonderful.
Yeah.
Everything's great. But I think at the time, the worst decision I ever made was not sticking with baseball. Yeah. I knew too many big-time coaches. I knew Larry Smith really well. I had fall games with him. I'd call him and ask him, would he play us in the fall? Yes. Yeah. Coach Earl at MTSU. Yeah, come on down. And then some of the other colleges. I knew all of the coaches. I know I could have got an assistant coaching job somewhere and worked my way up to be a head coach. And to this day, I really think I would have been or could have been a big-time college coach.
Had you stayed there. You know, you mentioned earlier that your dad went to Cumberland. I read where he had to talk about his touchdown against Vanderbilt in 1935 when he was a halfback on the Cumberland football team.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And he did. They ran the old single wing.
Oh, yeah.
And he was a punter. And he was the punter for the team. And I tell you, even after I got old 10 years old, 11 years old, he was in his 40s and was still playing baseball. But he would get out in the backyard and he would punt. And I mean, he could still punt at that age. And I mean, it was amazing that he could do that. But
now your dad was Elvin Lindsay. You said his nickname was Toby.
Toby.
As far as I can tell, he spent 6 seasons in the minors, 2 of them in the Nashville Vols. So let me go through some of these things. The year before joining Nashville in 1942, he was 17-11 for Hot Springs in the Cotton States League. Mm-hmm. His best season before that was in Bowling Green when he was 14-2.
Mm-hmm.
And after he made the team in Nashville in 1942, actually was in spring training with Nashville in 41. But after he made the team coming out of spring training in 42, he pitched in an exhibition game against the New York Yankees on April the 5th that year.
Yes.
You remember him talking about that?
Yes. He talked about pitching against Bill Dickey. And that name stuck out more than anything because of him being a catcher everything. But yes, he talked about that. Yes.
He relieved Charlie Gassaway and got Phil Rizzuto on a pop-up with 2 outs in the 8th. And then with 2 out in the 9th, he gave up 2 hits and 2 runs as the Yankees ended up winning 10-1. In May, after appearing in 6 games with no decisions because Larry Gilbert had him as a reliever, he was optioned to Charleston in the South Atlantic League. He went 10-3, so he still had some good seasons behind him.
Yeah.
He returned to spring training with the Vols in 1943. They were spring training in Macon, Georgia. And Tennessean sports writer Raymond Johnson reported on April 1, that your dad showed up that day without his glove and had to go to a local sporting goods store to purchase one.
I don't remember that story now.
That was pretty good. In the second game of the doubleheader on May the 2nd, he held Chattanooga to 4 hits and a shutout with the Vols winning 3-0. Primarily as a reliever, it was his first start for Nashville. And on May the 12th, this is in 43, he blanked the Knoxville Smokies 2-0, the first shutout pitched in Sulphurdale by a Nashville pitcher in several years. By June, he'd also driven in 10 runs, the most of any pitcher in the Southern Association to date. On July the 22nd, your dad, with a record of 4-6, was purchased by Knoxville.
Yes.
2 days later, he tossed a shutout against Little Rock, winning 1-0. He gave up 6 hits, but he got the only Smokies hit and 1-0. And he had the same record with Knoxville that year as he did with Nashville. He was 4-6, so 8-12 for the season. Did he retire after that season? Because there's no pro record of him.
No, he chipped a bone in his elbow.
Yeah.
And of course, they didn't have the Tom and John surgery or whatever back then. But he joined the Navy. Yeah. He went in the Navy.
Gotcha.
Didn't see any action, but he was in the Navy.
Yeah, thank you for the service.
Yes. Well, but he, Raymond Johnson, wrote an article. Daddy was always a good hitter. He was always a good hitter. And Raymond Johnson compared him to Babe Ruth and said, you know, they took Babe Ruth off of the mound and put him in the outfield. Could this be the next Babe Ruth? I have that article. And it was a great article for my dad. But I can remember in Little League, we had a father-son game. And Daddy came to the plate. Now, all the other fathers were, you know, they were hit using both hands. Daddy came to the plate and used one hand. One hand. And he hit one way out of the ballpark with one hand. So I was proud of that. And then as I got older, he played in a Babe Ruth father-son game, and he actually hit another home run out of Pillow Park that time.
That's awesome.
But my dad died at age 51, and he never did get to see me play any college sports.
Right.
And that is one thing that I probably regret the most about my life with my dad, that he didn't get to see me play any college sports because he got sick in 1966 and passed away in 66. And he couldn't come to my freshman game because he was in the hospital, and he died in that December. But he was 51. And he died of colon cancer. This is kind of off subject a little bit, but my oldest son was 43, and he passed away with colon cancer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, me too. When I got divorced in 1979 or 80, I had a son 12 and a son 3, and my son 12 wanted to live with me.
Yeah.
And my son 3 wanted to live with her, and I didn't really want to split up the brothers, but I didn't want to divorce it. My wife did. But I figured, hey, if they split up, maybe she'll want to get back together, you know, Mrs. Son. But my 12-year-old, I stuck around. If it hadn't been for him, I don't think I'd be here today, because I raised him as a single parent until he went off to college. And he had to change schools at least two or three times. And we moved back to Columbia back in 84, 85. And he went to Columbia High School. And they said, are you David Lindsay's son? And he said, yeah. And they said, do you play baseball or football? And of course, I never pushed him into anything. He was more academic. He graduated from Tennessee Tech with a mechanical engineer degree. And my other son is 40-something now. I just can't think of their ages.
Yeah.
But he graduated from Tennessee Tech with a civil engineering degree. And he's the one that has my two grandchildren.
Yeah. So what are your boys' names?
My oldest son's name was Tim. And we had a very special bond because we went through a lot of ups and downs, moving and changing school and stuff like that. And he was a lot like me. He was a jokester. And then my youngest son is Kevin, and we now have a special bond, especially since he has my two grandchildren. I have a granddaughter that's a junior at UT Chattanooga, who's into nursing, and then I have a grandson, Benton, that's 10. And the good story about that is that he was 5 weeks early being born, but he was born on November the 10th, my birthday.
Awesome.
My son called me and he says, you're not going to believe this, but we just had, Benton was born today. I said, oh, what a present. Yeah. My granddaughter's name is Lexi.
Lexi, that's awesome. Now, look, you also, I don't want to go too far into, you went into teaching. Because you taught in the Hendersonville system for a long time, didn't you?
Yes.
Coached girls basketball. I mean, I admire you, David, for not only your career, your family. Family is everything, I think, to most of us.
Yes.
You've also three runner-up honors with Knox Doss in Sumner County Championships, twice being coach of the year. Spent a few seasons as an assistant football coach.
Yeah.
Also, the last question I want to ask you.
Well, Skip, let me ask, tell you how that came about. Let me tell you how that came about, right. Because I want to say something about that. Yeah. I was down in Columbia just trying to make ends meet with my son going to school. I was substitute teaching. I was working at my younger brother, Dan, he owned the Captain D's in Columbia. Yeah. And I was working for him at Captain D's. And my son was working at Captain D's. And he told me, he said, if Tim had not been just 16 years old, he would have made him manager of the store. That's how much he appreciated my son and how smart my son was. And my son would bring home supper from Captain D's a lot. But anyway, I got a call from my best friend, Steve Garner. Steve Garner pitched at Cumberland College.
Yeah.
And he transferred to David Lipscomb the same time that I did.
Yeah.
And I caught Steve for my junior and senior year in college, and he became one of my best friends. And I was in Columbia one day, and the phone rang, and it was Steve. And he said, hey, he said, I got a job for you. I said, what is it, Steve? And he said, you can be a head girls basketball coach at Knox Doss. I said, Steve, I don't know nothing about girls basketball. He said, oh, David, he said, you're a coach. You can coach anything. Yeah. And I said, all right, well, I'm going to come up and interview. And I went up and interviewed with the principal, Lonnie Newton. And within 10 minutes, he said, you're hired.
That's awesome.
And
pretty good credentials, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I'm going to tell you, if you haven't coached 6th and 7th and 8th grade girls basketball, you don't know what coaching is like. I'm telling you, that's an age that they know everything about nothing.
Yeah, I guess so. All right, back to the last question I'm going to ask you.
All right.
Have you ever been back to Cumberland?
Oh, I know. Oh, yeah.
Do you remember how we met?
I've been back.
How we met?
Yes. And I've been back once before that. And I sometimes won't take a sledgehammer and just demolish all the nice things they have. It is unbelievable what a professional outfit they've got now. And Woody Hunt, I know he's turned the job over to his son,
Ryan,
but Woody did such a tremendous job there. And I guess the whole administration changed once they become a university. But, I mean, they've got offices, they've got locker rooms and field of artificial turf and dugouts.
A lot of changes after 50 years, right?
It is. And you know, I can't believe it's been 50 years. Seems like it was just a couple of weeks ago, but it's been a long time. But they've come a long way, and I'm proud of them. Proud of Woody. He's done a tremendous job, and I wish that I could have stuck there longer, but it was just time for me to go without any help.
Well, when I was there and you and I met, I don't remember the year, but you were named to the Hall of Fame there, and that was an honor that obviously was deserved. I have told my wife and others that through baseball, I have met so many wonderful people, some I could not have ever met outside of baseball. I met, of course, Woody and Ryan. They've got they're doing such great things, and that's continuing. And I met you that night, and I count you as that. And Tommy Bryan, you know,
he's a nice guy.
He's a landmark in Lebanon, and what a nice guy. And through those relationships, I'll never forget guys like you. Well, I want to thank you for being a part of this, because it's just been a joy for me. You and I have talked for many times, either typed each other back and forth to each other and talked a time or two. But I want to thank you for doing this.
Skip, this has been truly an honor and something I will never forget for the rest of my life. And I've always considered you a friend. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.